Welcome to the Garden Cinema Weekly Podcast, where we tell you what's coming up at London's newest independent cinema, including new releases, seasons and special events, and interviews with filmmakers and other guests. This week, we have film professor Jose Arroyo discussing Penelope Cruz, our curator Dr. George Crosthwaite talking to us about British noir, and our director Michael Chambers speaking to Art Deco outfit Hotsi Totsi. Our new release this week is Panah Panahi's Hit the Road, which received 5-star reviews from Mark Kermode and Peter Bradshaw. The film follows an Iranian family driving to the Turkish border to try and smuggle their son out of the country. We're also showing a number of one-off screenings, including Amir Questlove Thompson's Oscar-winning documentary Summer of Soul as part of our Musical Fridays, described by Mark Kermode as the best music documentary he's ever seen, and Terry Gilliam's Time Bandits, which is our family film and will be showing on the 13th and 14th of August.
General sale tickets for our upcoming preview screening of Penelope Cruz's latest film, Official Competition, are now live. The screening will be held on Saturday, the 20th of August at 8:30 p.m. In this satire of art house filmmaking, Cruz plays director Lola Cuevas, who is tasked with making a hit film by an aging wealthy businessman. Given carte blanche over casting, she pits acclaimed but stiflingly snobbish actor Ivan Torres against handsome but superficial screen icon Felix Rivero, believing that the inevitable tension between the two can only help the film's dynamic. This screening is part of our ongoing season celebrating Penelope Cruz. We're showing the actor's best films throughout August, including Vicky Cristina Barcelona, Jamon Jamon, Parallel Mothers, and Volver. To mark the season, film professor Jose Arroyo joined us for a podcast recording to talk about Cruz, Almodovar, and the new wave of Spanish filmmakers. Here's Arroyo on Penelope Cruz.
I mean, in Volver, basically, she's playing a Sofia Loren role. Whereas, I mean, in Parallel Mothers, she's playing a professional woman. And Carne Tremula, you know, she's a rural peasant prostitute in Madrid, right?
Do you find her always well cast in that role, given this, they're always so diverse?
I do. And she's done extraordinary things for other people. It's, you know, it's not just to... She hasn't just shone with Almodovar. There's a fantastic film, which now escapes me, by Diego Yanez, where Victoria Abril and Penelope Cruz play angels. So, you know, Penelope Cruz is being punished, yeah, by God. She's in purgatory. And Victoria Abril is the good angel. So what is the film's idea of heaven? Is to sing samba in a bar in Paris, right? That's Victoria Abril. What's the film's idea of hell? Is, you know, for a gangster, yeah, to have to work as a prostitute and as a waitress in real life. That's the character Penelope Cruz plays, right? So she has to evoke the idea that she's a macho gangster, yeah, who's died and is now basically, yeah, in purgatory on his way to hell, being made to suffer what he's...
Who's the director?
It's Diego Yanez, I think. I mean, she's one of those people who initially you think, well, it's just a pretty girl, right? Like, it's not to be sneezed at, someone with that kind of beauty. But actually, it's when they grow into, yeah, the acting and then surprise you with it. I mean, I do compare her to Sophia Loren because, you know, Sophia Loren could have had a fantastic career just being beautiful, right? But then the fact that she could play comedy and different kinds of comedy, right? Like, she could do pratfalls, you know, she could do farce, she could do sophisticated comedy, yeah, and she could do, you know, kind of Una Giornata Particolare or Two Women, right? Then that becomes kind of genuinely extraordinary, and I do think that Penelope Cruz is like that.
You can listen to the entire podcast episode on the usual platforms by looking up the Garden Cinema Film Talk.
Our member screening is Max Offal's The Reckless Moment. This is a free member screening on the 16th of August at 8:40 p.m. Joan Bennett stars as a suburban housewife who covers up a murder to protect her teenage daughter, only to find herself blackmailed by an immoral, small-time crook played by James Mason. The Reckless Moment is a member's choice selection by Rebecca Robinson, who writes that this story, depicting, and I quote, the mounting tension as an ordinary woman finds herself in an extraordinary situation, rings authentically on many levels. James Mason's performance is heartbreaking and another of the film's highlights. Thank you very much, Rebecca Robinson. To suggest a film to be screened at the Garden Cinema, just select Propose a Film Screening on your membership account page. Please include the reasons for your request. The month of August will also see the start of our British film noir season, beginning with a screening of Carol Reed's The Third Man, starring Orson Welles, on Saturday, 13th of August. Pulp novelist Holly Martins travels to shadowy post-war Vienna, only to find himself investigating the mysterious death of an old friend, black market opportunist Harry Lime, and thus begins this legendary tale of love, deception and murder. Thanks to brilliant performances by Joseph Cotten, Ida Valley and Orson Welles, Anton Karas' evocative zither score, Graham Greene's razor-sharp dialogue and Robert Krasker's dramatic use of light and shadow, The Third Man only grows in stature as the years pass. Alongside The Third Man, the season also features regular screenings of films such as It Always Rains on a Sunday, Brighton Rock and Odd Man Out. Here's our very own film curator, George, to talk to us a bit more about the choices behind the British noir season.
Thanks, Abla. So regular visitors to the Garden Cinema will know that we've been on this journey around film noir, moving around the world for some months now. And we started with very classic Hollywood film noir. And we recently were just coming to the end of our cycle of French noir. And we're moving now, it seems appropriately, into the third, probably strongest locus of film noir production in the 1940s and 1950s, which is on these shores, and it's British film noir. Why we've separated these three national brandings of noir out is because you do get very particular characteristics in each country you visit. So most people think of film noir, they probably think of Hollywood film noir, they think of maybe LA, they think of it at night, they think of Humphrey Bogart, they think of people smoking, it's raining. It rains more in LA in film noir than it does in reality. They think of hats, perhaps. But when we get to British film noir, we retain that kind of psychological depth of American film noir. Remember, this is a genre, this is a cycle of films that's coming out during the war, coming out post-World War II. And a lot of it's dealing with that psychological damage that was done to people who experienced that, the damage that was done to those who didn't directly experience that, those who stayed at home. And whilst in American noir, that tends to retain on a psychological level, in British noir, what's fascinating is we see the physical scars of that conflict. So if you come to the season and you watch Brighton Rock, you see It Always Rains on Sunday, you see that literal damage that's done by the war to the buildings, to the environments of noir, as well as the psychological trauma that is being dealt with in these films. In American film noir, we're used to the figures of the gangster. We're used to the figures of the hard-boiled private detective. These are quite romantic figures. When we get to these shores, it's not quite so classy. Instead, we get the figure of the two-bit hustler, the petty black market racketeer, the spiv. It's a very British, very English character. Even in perhaps the most famous of these films that you've trailed so well here, The Third Man, they're not necessarily glamorous figures. Orson Welles definitely lends a certain gravitas and a huge amount of charisma to the role of Harry Lime. But at the end of the day, he is a kind of bottom feeder in that film. And I suppose, actually, The Third Man is the star of this particular run here. And for many people, it might be the film they think of when they think of film noir, even though it's set in a very unique location, which is post-war, occupied and divided Vienna. It has this magical zither score, as you mentioned, which is completely bizarre when you put it next to the music of other film noirs, perhaps. And yet it has retained this kind of legacy and it only grows in stature, as you said. It does perhaps look the most like a film noir. It's probably the most evocative and striking use of that chiaroscuro cinematography, high contrast, light and shadow, and those canted angles. In fact, the angles in The Third Man are so tilted that the story goes that the Hollywood director William Wyler sent Carol Reed a spirit measure after he saw the film. But beyond that, we've also got Carol Reed's Odd Man Out, which you might see as a kind of rehearsal for The Third Man in a way. You get that sense of him developing this visual sensibility and these incredibly evocative images, although in a very different story set in Belfast. Another thing to say about British noir is how it relates to other genres. So Hollywood noir perhaps relates more pertinently back to something like screwball comedy, even, or other Hollywood gangster films from the 30s. But British noir, and I hope people who come to see films like It Always Rains on Sunday will see this, we can see it as something that is really looking forward to British social realism, which is going to become this key genre or cycle of filmmaking in this country in the 1960s, and something we cherish and we look back upon as this perhaps new wave period of British filmmaking. So it In Always Rains on Sunday, you've got a noirish plot about an escaped convict on the run. He's hiding out in his ex-lover's house. There's a manhunt on for him. That plot is effectively sidelined entirely in favour of this portrait of a neighbourhood, which is the East End, bomb-damaged East End post-war, and this housewife who's trying to kind of keep her life together. And we see all of these supporting characters pop up. And what we get is effectively the kind of incisive look at the domestic situation of mundane everyday life. It always rains on Sunday. It's always Sunday. This is just any other Sunday. And if you compare that film to what comes later in the late 50s and 1960s, you get the beginnings of perhaps one of the most important film movements ever seen in this country. So I hope people come to these films and have a really good time. They are entertaining films. They are film noir. They have all of those attractive qualities that we seek in them. But I also hope they can see them in a particular context of what it would have been like to live at this time, what it's like to make films at this time, what you're doing with limited resources, completely damaged locations. And I hope that forms some kind of synthesis of why we've separated British noir out and seeing it as a particularly British form of filmmaking.
Yeah, thank you very much. That's really interesting. You've really pinpointed out the uniqueness of British noir compared to other countries' noir scene, I guess. So thanks very much for that, George. I'd like to ask you, is there any specific film as part of that canon of films that you really like, a coup de cœur, so to speak?
Of the five films we're showing, Jules Dassin's Night in the City is perhaps my favourite film noir ever made. Again, it's the London docks. It's you see that effect of the war on the physical landscape, on the locations. It's also interesting as a kind of Hollywood on tour film, perhaps. Jules Dassin as a Hollywood director. There's big Hollywood stars in it, like Gene Tierney. But it's really unique, and it feels very London to me. It's got these amazing kind of pre-dawn fog sequences. It's got a whole subplot involving backroom wrestling. And Jules Dassin is someone, he'd made The Naked City by this point in New York, which is perhaps not a fantastic film, but is very special in terms of its location shooting. It's pretty much entirely shot on location, which was quite rare for the 1940s. And he's about to be blacklisted in the Hollywood blacklist, the McCarthy witch hunts of the 1950s. And he's about to be kicked out of Hollywood, or he's going to leave Hollywood. He's about to become a huge name in France, and he's going to make several key French noirs, in fact, including Rififi. Later in life, he's going to move to Greece and become a star in Greece of his own right as well. and we can maybe see him as someone who had this great outsider's eye, who was able to move into a different setting, into a different culture, and peel away certain things that weren't perhaps apparent to those who lived within that culture. So it's a very special film to me, and I'm really happy to show it here, and I'm really looking forward to seeing it on the big screen. In fact, apart from The Third Man, I think I haven't seen any of these films in the cinema. So what a treat.
Lovely, and a treat for us all. Thanks very much, George. And I should probably point out at this point that if you wish to know more about French film noir, we did record a podcast episode with Professor Ginette Vincendeau, and you can find that on the Garden Cinema Film Talk on the usual podcasting platform.
The Garden Cinema is a new independent cinema in the heart of Covent Garden. We show a combination of repertory seasons with a focus on classic and world cinema, as well as carefully selected new releases. Join our community of film lovers by becoming a member. Membership costs just £20 for life. With that, you'll receive a free ticket and £2 off every screening for you and a friend. You will also be able to propose films for our free fortnightly member screenings. Members also receive pre-sale access to special events and seasons. Join now at thegardencinema.co.uk/membership.
Also showing at the Garden Cinema, Eric Revilius, Drawn to War, which follows the enigmatic wartime British artist Eric Revilius. Fire of Love, the story of couple Katia and Maurice Kraft, who have a passion for volcanoes. For 2 decades, the daring French volcanologist couple roam the planet, chasing eruptions and documenting their journey. The Harder They Come, which celebrates its 50th anniversary this year, and the classic Wim Wenders film Paris, Texas.
Mike Lee in conversation. The acclaimed writer-director Mike Lee will be our first artist-in-residence as he joins us across September and October for a 2-part retrospective of his cinematic career. All 14 of Mike Lee's films for the cinema will be shown. Each screening will be followed by a discussion and a Q&A session with Mike Lee and his friend and collaborator Gary Yershon, who has curated the season. This is the first season of Mike Lee's films that has been curated with the intention of charting the development of his artistic career. The collection of films in both parts are ordered chronologically in order to create an ongoing conversation that will develop across the series of screenings and discussions. Part 1 will run from the 8th of September until the 17th of September and will include such films as Bleak Moments, Life is Sweet, Secrets and Lies and Vera Drake. Part 2 will run from the 17th of October to the 30th of October and will include, amongst others, Career Girls, Topsy Turvy, Happy Go Lucky and Peterloo. Tickets are selling fast, so don't miss your chance to be a part of this extensive exploration of Mike Lee's films, guided by the filmmaker himself.
Finally, our founder and director, Michael Chambers, spoke last week to Hotsy Totsy about the origins and ideas behind the cinema.
Can you tell us a bit about the cinema, what it is, what it does, and why you started it in the first place?
Okay. Well, it's what they call a repertory cinema. In other words, we do show new releases, but alongside that, we like to have our seasons of films that we choose for whatever the season happens to be, like I think it's French film noir at the moment, and then we're having a wonderful season in October when you're here. We'll have the season with Mike Lee, who's 14 of his films we're showing, and he's going to speak. He's going to be on the platform after every screening, and he'll talk about the films and he'll answer questions. He'll probably spend an hour to an hour and a half after each screening. No, it's wonderful. He's a great supporter of the cinema. So that'll be a tremendous
Oh, my goodness. Season. Well, you know what? When I was looking at the website, and as a Northerner, Mike Lee has got a place in our hearts, hasn't he?
Yeah, yeah.
And he's a living legend, let's be honest. Yeah, and I mean, won't that be incredible? And to hear it from the horse's mouth after each film.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just too special, isn't it? Yeah. It's incredible.
He's talking to, it'll be Mike Lee and a friend of his who is a composer called Gary Yershon, who composes the soundtracks for his, the music for his films.
Oh, goodness. So imagine the insight and what they're going to tell
us. It'll be a good discussion.
Oh, too much. I've got goosebumps. So, Michael, why did you start it? Have you always obviously been into film? Is it a huge love? And what made you think, you know what, I'm going to open a cinema?
My family, my father was a film director. My two sons make films. The oldest one makes lots of television, factual, you know, documentary films for television. I should have gone into it myself when I was young. I went to the bar instead and became a lawyer, which was probably a mistake. Anyway, and then I started a book publishing business. And now at the advanced age of 80, I've got the opportunity now to do a bit in films and maybe even produce a few. But this thing started because we acquired this office here in Covent Garden about 10 years ago, and the office we left had an art gallery, a lovely art gallery on the street level facing the pavement, and I thought it'd be nice to start an art gallery in this building. But it wasn't possible to have it on the pavement, on that level, ground floor. The only place for it really was in the basement. So I went down and it was big enough, but it was very dark. And I thought, well, an art gallery in the dark isn't ideal, really.
New.
So instead of an art gallery with, you know, static pictures, I thought we'd have moving pictures and open a cinema. That's a Amazing. Step back into film, you know. As a, and
absolutely.
And that's what we did. And it's converted very well. We've got two screens. And on the ground floor, we're now put planning application into the Camden Council to open a third screen.
Fabulous.
And so it'll be a three-screen cinema. It'll still be art house cinema, really. Niche repertory cinema. And the screen, they're not large. One auditorium's got 80 seats, the other's got 40, and the new one will have 80. So altogether we'll have about 200, but in terms of cinemas, that's not big. But it'll serve its purpose as a niche art house cinema in Covent Garden. So
it's incredible.
That's what we're doing. Yeah.
And do you think, I can speak from a consumer, that there is a need and a desire for this, almost this intimacy around film. You know, the multiplexes, you know, they're a bit scary, if I'm honest, I feel anyway. And they sort of lose that touch, don't you, with the film, because it's such a personal experience. And do you feel there is a rise of the need for this sort of thing where people want to come and, you know, immerse themselves, really?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I'm new to it myself here. I've just opened it. I know that the cinema we've created here, it's got a lovely space for an Art Deco bar. It's a large area that we converted to a bar, which wouldn't have done for a screen. And it's wonderful. So I had a great time. And that's very friendly. It's a very friendly, intimate. It's got lots of booths in it.
It looks incredible.
When you come, you'll like it. You must come to visit us.
I'm going to. I know. I think.
See the inside. Yeah.
I know. If you go onto the Garden Cinema's website, anybody who's listening, there's a brilliant video, isn't there, that you can watch and you sort of get taken through to the bar.
You can see the bar on the website.
Yeah.
Right.
It's incredible. And with Hotsy Totsy, we're very much Art Deco 1920s era. Yeah. So it is completely. Yeah. Our vibe, so we cannot wait to come and visit. Very, very excited. So how do you begin to pick the films that you're going to show? It must be overwhelming, I imagine, because you can delve into the archives from so many years and stuff, you know. Where do you begin?
Well, the new releases, of course, come and grab you themselves. You don't have much choice. And a lot of them, of course, are rather disappointing, I find, anyway. But we selected the new releases, those we think are good films and suit the cinema. And as you say, with seasons, looking at the... And it's not just Hollywood or British films. We look at the whole world of cinema. And French, German, Russian, Spanish, Scandinavian, South American... Chinese. I mean, the whole world of film, it's just, as you say, an extraordinary resource that you could spend your life looking through these films.
Oh, goodness.
But it starts with an idea. You have an idea. What should we should we do a season about Art Deco, for instance? Shall we do an Art Deco season? exploring the whole subject of Art Deco and seeing what sort of films. I mean, you haven't really got Art Deco films, although you've got the silent era where you have, especially among the German expressionists, you have a sort of Art Deco flavour to the films. You could use some of those.
Yeah,
and you could have some documentaries that have no doubt been made on the subjects, and a few travelogues maybe that visit the Art Deco centres of the world.
It sounds incredible.
Like Miami.
Yes.
Australia, other countries where they've and all the Art Deco cinemas in England.
So beautiful, aren't they? The architecture. And I find it fascinating, that era as well, because it was when a lot of movie stars transferred from silent films, didn't they, to talking films. And in the late 20s. And I just think, you know, it was mainly women a lot, wasn't it, that they were just seen as these, you know, femme fatale, beautiful icons. And then suddenly they had a voice, and it was just this mad transition for the audience, wasn't it? And I imagine them as well. And it was such a special time in cinema, wasn't it? It was, you know, a sensory overload, I imagine.
Well, it was the transition to talkies. As you say, suddenly cinema became mass popular, and the demand for new cinemas absolutely mushroomed. And so in the early 30s, well, throughout the 30s, really, they went to town building new cinemas, and giant cinemas. I mean, the cinema in Kilburn, for instance.
Yes.
The Art Deco cinema there.
Huge.
And so you get these wonderful Art Deco cinemas, which they turned into bingo halls, lots of them.
Oh, I know.
Of course, but they're still standing.
They are. There's one in Tooting that's a bingo hall, and it's the most gorgeous building in the world. And you're like, okay, get my dabber out.
Well, bingo will come and go, but I'm sure that one day the cinemas will be perhaps...
Yes.
Found a really good entertainment use again, which would be nice.
Definitely, absolutely. Yeah. We're in Walthamstow. We've got this incredible Art Deco old theatre, and Soho Theatre have acquired it and are now,
good.
Which is wonderful, you know, to have live theatre and film back, which is incredible. So it does seem to be becoming a bit full circle, that people are very much falling back in love with film and very much wanting to discover old films and old classics. I hope so. I think they are, definitely. But it's so brilliant. I mean, you had, like, I was looking on your website, you've got like the Long Good Friday on and things like that, which is, you know, for someone like me that loves that film, but I would never have dreamed I could see it on a screen, you know. It's so special, isn't it?
Well, it's different on the screen. It's however big your screen at home, it's not the same as being in front of this huge screen with other people watching it and the sound, decent sound. Yes, it's an experience that it's worth preserving.
Oh, goodness. It's so brilliant. And I mean, what a welcome addition. And so, you know, you mentioned Mike Leigh before, and I was reading that you had the backing of Ken Loach as well. Is that right?
Oh, yes, the two of them. They were extremely helpful initially with our planning.
And how did that come about? Did you have a relationship with them, or did you just approach them and say, listen, this is what I'm thinking. Would you back it?
You know, I can't remember. I can't remember.
But they heard about it and were all for it.
I think either one way or the other. I don't know quite which way it went. But they came, and when I told them what we were doing, they were very keen. They liked the idea. Mike Leigh lives just around the corner.
Oh, so that's helpful.
Near the British Museum. And so this is his local cinema.
Amazing.
Yes, so he comes here quite often.
I don't think I could really concentrate on the film if Mike Leigh was sat next to me, to be honest with you.
Well, the thing about cinema is you're in the dark.
You don't know.
And there's a big screen in front of you. You get lost in the film.
Absolutely. And that's a sign of a good film, isn't it? It doesn't matter, Mike Leigh. I'll talk to you later. Watching this. Incredible. So, I mean, they're just, you know, stalwarts of the industry, aren't they? You know, they are living legends, let's be honest.
In British film, yeah.
They're, oh, my goodness.
They're so, giants in our own
absolutely.
Film
We're so lucky to still have them. And isn't it wonderful that they decided, you know, to go out their way and back this and to sort of cement it?
It helps enormously. Yeah.
Oh, fabulous. So, Michael, I know obviously it's only been open a few months, hasn't it? So what's your dreams and aspirations for it? Just to keep doing what you're doing, or will there be ever a Garden Cinema 2?
I want to make a success of this cinema.
Yeah.
Put a lot into it. And a Garden Cinema 2. Well, I mean, that's in the future. I wouldn't hazard a guess there, I can't say. But my desire is now to learn to do what my father did and make films myself.
Oh my goodness, how incredible. Well,
but at my age it'll be difficult, but I might be able to produce some.
Yeah. Have you got any ideas of what you would like to do, or is it already written? Or
I've written a couple of scripts already.
Amazing, that's so incredible.
Which people encourage me to film, they say they're good.
Well, get Mike and Ken on it, be fine.
Yes.
They won't mind.
He might give me some advice on it, but
exactly.
He's got his own projects, yeah.
He might be quite busy. Exactly. Yeah. That's incredible, and all the luck with it, you know. We'd love to follow that and see that through. And isn't it? I mean, you were saying that obviously you worked in the legal profession for a long time, you've found your passion. You've reignited it again. Isn't it wonderful?
Well, it's wonderful to. I published books for about 30. Starting 1969, so
wow.
That's 50 years.
Goodness.
So I published books for 50 years, non-fiction. Mm. And then I sold it about 4 years ago and built the cinema.
Amazing.
I have to tell you that running a cinema is so much more enjoyable than publishing books. Ah, absolutely.
Oh, it's wonderful.
It's a pleasure.
Yeah, it sounds like the best job in the world. I mean, you know, a Monday morning sitting there thinking about what season we're going to have. I mean, it doesn't get much better, does it?
Yeah. So you'd like a season on Art Deco,
yes,
would you?
Yes, please. And I'd like, you know, the Gloria Swanson era and, you know, the Clara Bow and all that, you know, the femme fatales of that.
Yeah.
Because, you know, at that time, women, I mean, we all think of the flappers and all that, don't we? But these women were really gritty, weren't they? They were really going against the status quo of what they're meant to be. And it's almost like we were talking about this something else, and it was almost like a roller coaster, because then in the 30s and the 40s they almost got put back in their box, didn't they, you know, to go be a housewife because the war was happening.
There's always a reaction after a big war.
Yes.
Same after the First World War, there was a crackdown. The right wing comes back into power and they crack down. So you had it the same in 1918 to sort of early 20s.
Which is why they went so mad, isn't it, when they got the chance? Exactly. It's fascinating. So yes, anything along those lines, Michael, will be fantastic, and we'll be there at every screening.
Okay.
You'll be like, gosh, can you leave Michael?
Well, I'll meet you all in October then.
You will.
And you can help me with this selection of films about
absolutely that. Don't joke, Mike. I'll be there with like a plan and a spreadsheet ready.
Thanks for listening. This was the Garden Cinema's weekly podcast. You can listen to full-length interviews at thegardencinema.co.uk/podcasts. You can become a member by visiting the website, and send us any other comments and feedback via our social media at The Garden Cinema.